Welcome to Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, a podcast brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. TIPQC exists to improve health outcomes for mothers and infants in Tennessee through our quality collaborative that will identify opportunities to optimize maternal and infant outcomes across our state and is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. The Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee podcast is designed for medical professionals and for patients and families across the state. We will focus on all aspects of the perinatal period with special attention to reducing our maternal mortality rate. This podcast is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health.
Welcome to Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, podcast brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. I am Dr. Anna Murad, the previous TIPQC Infant Medical Director. Today, we are delighted to have Dr. Shannon Walker joining us. Welcome, Shannon. Dr. Walker received her undergraduate degrees in biology and microbiology from the University of Georgia in Athens, Georgia. She attended medical school at the Wake Forest School of Medicine in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. She completed her pediatric residency, pediatric hematology oncology fellowship, and transfusion medicine fellowship at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. She is currently at Vanderbilt University Medical Center as an assistant professor in the Department of Pathology, Microbiology, and Immunology with a joint appointment in the Department of Pediatrics. Her research focuses on pediatric hemostasis and thrombosis, predictive modeling, clinical trial design and execution, and hematology-related vaccine complications. That is quite the impressive resume, Dr. Walker. We are so delighted to have you. Can you tell us a little bit about your career trajectory and how you ended up being interested in this field?
Sure. So I went into medicine, basically being interested in the field of pediatrics. I was always drawn to the field of pediatric hematology. I have a family member with a bleeding disorder, and so kind of grew up on the patient side of things. And then kind of as I learned more about the practice of medicine and the fields of pediatrics and hematology, there was just a lot that drew me to that field in terms of both the patient population, some of the newer kind of treatment options that are available. And it really just spoke to me in terms of how do we work up our patients and those sorts of things. So kind of planned my career course to kind of end up and let me be kind of the hematology specialist in the field of pediatric hematology and oncology here at Vanderbilt. Although I am trained as a general pediatrician, and then I do see patients in our transfusion medicine and blood bank service as well.
Well, I certainly have benefited from your knowledge over the years. I always appreciate the consults that you are able to give us. Today, we want to focus on vitamin K. There was a recent research letter published in JAMA on December 8th that indicated the rates of refusal for vitamin K have increased from 2.9 in 2017 to 5.18. And that's a pretty large increase. And it's one that I see pretty much on a daily basis as the medical director of our newborn nursery, just this increasing number of families who are declining this very important medication at birth. So I would like to talk about the rationale for why it's recommended and hopefully dispel some myths that I often hear as reasons why families are declining it.
Sure, that sounds great.
So can you tell us a little bit about why newborns even need vitamin K and how it came about? What is it?
Sure. So vitamin K is one of your coagulation factors. It was actually discovered by two scientists back in the early 20th century who received the Nobel Prize for Medicine for their discovery. And the K is because the word coagulation in German has a K in it. And so it is an important cofactor for your clotting cascades, for a lot of your body's ability to make a strong and healthy blood clot. Unfortunately, babies are born with very low levels of it. Vitamin K doesn't cross the placenta well from mom into babies. And then the majority of adults, we get our vitamin K through either our diet. Leafy green vegetables have a lot of vitamin K. And babies obviously aren't eating a lot of leafy green vegetables. And then we also get vitamin K from some of the kind of our microbiome that lives in our gut and those sorts of things. And babies are still developing that as well. So it's kind of a twofold reason why they don't have a lot of vitamin K. And so it's important for us to kind of support the babies, give them some vitamin K to try and help prevent any derangements in their clotting cascades that might develop, which we'll talk about in a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's super important to point out that we have been using vitamin K as standard of care since the 1960s, 1961, the American Academy of Pediatrics introduced the concept that this was a necessary medication to be given to all newborns. And it's pretty much been used in all U.S. births since that period of time. What is the downside of not getting your vitamin K, of not giving it to your baby? What happens or what could happen?
So babies who don't get the vitamin K injection at birth are at higher risk for developing bleeding. And the bleeding that they can develop is what we call vitamin K deficient bleeding, or VKDB. It's split into kind of three different flavors, which are kind of based on the time point from when they develop. So babies can have early vitamin K deficient bleeding, which is really within the first day or two of life, which is more related to mom being on certain medications that even further suppress baby's levels of vitamin K. So some seizure medicine, some blood clotting medicines, those sorts of things. Then we have classic vitamin K deficient bleeding, which occurs between days two and days seven or so of life, kind of in that first week. And this is kind of what we see most frequently in babies who don't get the injection. They're at risk for bleeding. They can develop GI bleeding, bleeding into their gut, bleeding into their brain. They can have kind of serious bleeding related to that. And then the one that I think we're seeing a little bit more frequently and is kind of more related to patients not getting the vitamin K injection at delivery is what we call late vitamin K deficient bleeding, which really occurs in that kind of second week, really up till about 12 weeks of life. And that's where babies might have some kind of more minor bleeding that is not really appreciated, but can then develop kind of tragic bleeding, bleeding into their brain that requires surgical interventions, or bleeding into their GI tract, which can cause a significant amount of blood loss before it's really appreciated. And these babies can have kind of long-term impacts related to their bleeding complications.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that really, something that I wish people understood a little bit better. Out of those types of vitamin K, I've never seen early. That's the one I've never seen, but I've seen classic and I've seen late. It's really a tragedy when those things happen. Why does the vitamin K, why is it given as an injection?
So it's given as an injection because the babies aren't very good at absorbing vitamin K, just related to some of their gut immaturity. And then also because we don't have a standard formulation of oral vitamin K in the United States. And so there's not really good standards in terms of your oral vitamin K formulations, how much is in there. It's not regulated. There's not a standard kind of dosing recommendation. The injection of the vitamin K that the infants get at birth helps kind of them prevent the bleeding in the immediate moment. So it helps prevent that kind of classic vitamin K deficient bleeding that we would see early, but then also allows the baby to have some vitamin K stored in their liver so that as their own levels are kind of ramping up over time, that can help prevent that late vitamin K deficient bleeding as well.
Have you personally cared for infants with vitamin K deficiency bleeding?
I have. We've had several that have come in over the past year that have had bleeding into their brain with intracranial hemorrhage. And we often get involved as the hematology service whenever there are kind of like lab abnormalities related to patients bleeding and clotting. And so we've been getting calls about these patients who have very severe bleeding to kind of make sure that there's not an underlying kind of inherited bleeding problem that's going on. But these patients have received vitamin K, their labs have corrected very quickly, their bleeding has resolved, but you know, some of the complications that they have go on over time. So we've had a few that we've seen both in the hospital, and then we've also followed them up in our clinic just to send some additional testing after their labs have normalized, after they're not acutely ill in the hospital, to make sure that we're not missing anything as well.
One important point that you touched on earlier is the symptoms of vitamin K deficiency bleeding can be very subtle. And so oftentimes these infants don't present until they've had a catastrophic bleed. And then, yes, their levels do correct pretty quickly with vitamin K, but the after effects, the injury can persist. And so the morbidity and mortality of these vitamin K deficiency bleeds that occur late can be pretty high. Is that correct?
Yes, that's definitely correct. So you can fix the laboratory numbers fairly quickly by giving vitamin K to patients who are deficient in it and are having bleeding related to that. But if you're already having significant bleeding into your brain or into another kind of enclosed space in your body, that can cause significant problems that even if you fix the bleeding, you might still have complications related to that. Some patients, there's been reports of fatalities. I haven't personally cared for any fatalities from vitamin K deficient bleeding, but I think there's certainly reports from Vanderbilt of these that have happened in the past.
Yeah, it's really a little heartbreaking when we think about the consequences of this vitamin K deficiency bleeding. So let's talk a little bit about some of the misinformation or myths that can lead families to be unsure about whether to get their vitamin K for their newborn. And I'm going to go through the ones I commonly hear, and I'll let you fill in the ones that you've heard. I think one of the things that I can say is I've been doing this for about 25 years, and I never had a family refuse or decline their vitamin K until maybe 10 to 15 years ago. And it really seems to have mirrored some of the distrust in medicine in general. And I think it's really important that we make sure that we're having an open conversation with families so that they have the space to make these decisions, but then we give them accurate information as much as we can. So the first thing that I think I hear is because it's a shot, people assume it's a vaccination. You're nodding. So that must be one you've heard pretty commonly as well.
Yes, I've heard that as well. It gets lumped in, I think, with other kind of vaccines, but it's certainly not a vaccine in any way. It's a vitamin that the babies just aren't able to make at that time in their life. But there's no sort of vaccine or immune response or anything like that that is related to it.
And I will say anecdotally, some of my families who have declined this supplement are families that would be very amenable to supplements in other areas of their life. And so it's always interesting to me. I keep saying the word, I say medication, but honestly, we probably should emphasize this is a vitamin, it's a supplement, that it's not natural or that it can cause psychological harm. So that's the other one I hear all the time is that, you know, we were created naturally. Why would we add something else to a newborn?
Yeah. And I think this is a tricky one. I'm a parent personally, and I think that it's hard when your own child is there, you're going to do something to them that they're not necessarily going to enjoy. And I think sometimes it's really hard for parents to kind of wrap their heads around doing something that they know is going to hurt their own child. I think we've been lucky in this kind of sphere of medicine and this time of medicine that we don't really remember things. I wasn't born in 1961 when we started recommending the vitamin K injection. I mean, that was a long time ago. My mom was just being born. But I think that it's been several generations now. And so the ability for families to kind of know someone who they've had this happen to is pretty rare, because for a long time, the majority of babies in the U.S. did receive the vitamin K injection. And so I think sometimes it's a little bit hard to separate what we're recommending as a whole versus what parents feel for their child individually. And I think that that's where having some of those conversations and really explaining, you know, why we're recommending it, why we're recommending it as an injection, as opposed to kind of considering oral treatment and those sorts of things, really just allows some of those conversations to be had, allows the parents to kind of feel heard in a way that I think is important for us as the medical providers to also hear them and hear their concerns and have those kind of more individual conversations. Because that's really what I think the parents want, is they want what's best for their child, and how can we support them, and how can we give them the information that they need moving forward to help prevent some of these kind of rare but catastrophic outcomes that could occur.
I always try to point out, like, there are a lot of things we do to support an infant when they're first born, right? They get a little cold and don't warm up with skin to skin, we put them under the radiant warmer. If they have low glucoses, we give them glucose gels or IV fluids. I mean, there are things we do to support them as they're sort of making their entry to life. And also, we need to remember that infant mortality rates are in the 1900s were 165 per thousand. So, you know, we've gone down dramatically since then. We're around 7 per thousand, 1 per 1,000 at this point. And so, you know, some of these things that we do have lasting impact on our infant mortality rates. And to your point, I do think we want to make sure that families understand that this is not the only supportive thing that we offer. The next thing that we'll talk about is the boxed warning. And some people will refer to it as a black box warning, but it's technically just a boxed warning. And it's issued on the IV formulation that has benzyl alcohol in it, not on the form that we commonly use for newborns. Do you want to touch on that just for a second?
Sure. So certainly the IV and the intramuscular formulations are kind of manufactured in a different way. The boxed warning on the IV form for the benzyl alcohol, correct me if I'm wrong, I think is for more of kind of allergic type reactions, which we don't have that kind of preservative in the intramuscular form, which is the form that is offered to all infants at the time of delivery. And so I think sometimes people don't understand that there are kind of different formulations and different recommendations. And in the intramuscular format, we don't have that warning on that. We don't generally see any sort of reactions related to allergic type reactions at all.
Right. Yeah. And we are very careful to use the preservative-free formulation that is specific for our newborns. It basically has vitamin K, a plant-based vitamin K. It has polysorbate 80, which is a food-grade additive. It has some pH balancing agents, and it has propylene glycol, which is not ethylene glycol. So that's the other thing I sometimes hear is we're giving babies antifreeze. And that, of course, is incorrect. And so, you know, really when we're thinking about the ingredients, there are small amounts of these ingredients in this injectable format, basically to keep it soluble and so that it doesn't burn, so that you want to have that pH balance. And there are ways that you can mitigate the discomfort. You can give it while the baby's breastfeeding, you can give it while they're skin to skin. I mean, there's lots of different options of ways to kind of decrease that. The next myth that I hear oftentimes is that you only need it if you're a male infant and who's going to be circumcised. And if you wait until after the eighth day, because of the biblical reference to the eighth day, that would be fine because your vitamin K levels are normalized then. Is that true?
So we do not consider babies to have kind of normal vitamin K levels, normal coagulation pathways until they're a little bit closer to 6 months. So we also hear this as, you know, this eighth day kind of reference as to the point when even if babies don't get the vitamin K, that they can have procedures and those sorts of things. And I think that there's a lot of maturity in terms of the coagulation system that the babies are undergoing up until they're about 4 to 6 months of age. And so we certainly don't recommend patients undergoing any sort of procedures or anything like that if they haven't received the injected version of vitamin K, just because we're worried about the bleeding complications and the complications that we can have related to that.
I often speculate in my own head that some of the references to the eighth day are more about the mature milk and lactation going well. More so because that fits very nicely into that time frame, and that probably the baby was thriving by that eighth day and could tolerate a procedure. But I don't think it has anything to do with the vitamin K levels. The next thing that I sometimes will hear that it rears its head on occasion is that it causes jaundice. And I will tell you, jaundice is so ubiquitous in this newborn population. But if you look back at the original forms of vitamin K that were given, there were higher reports of jaundice. So there was some truth historically in that it may have caused some jaundice. But in this day and age, with the vitamin K formulations that we use, that is not correct. Is that your understanding as well?
Yes, and I've not seen any sort of jaundice related to our current formulation of vitamin K. My reading as well has kind of led me that the older version of vitamin K that was used was actually the vitamin K2, which did have higher rates of jaundice and complications related to that, whereas now the vitamin K that is used is the K1 version. And so it is tolerated in a different way and does not have any sort of complications related to jaundice.
That's always so interesting. The one I hear on occasion, but not as often, is that it's higher than the recommended daily allowance. And this one gets me because I'm like, yep, that's totally true. Can you explain a little bit about why there's a rationale for that?
Yes, it's definitely higher than the recommended allowance. But I think that we are also used to taking other vitamins and supplements higher than the recommended daily allowance. And so I'm not sure, you know, what the rationale is specifically on this one. But having the higher amount of vitamin K that the babies receive at right after delivery, again, allows them to kind of correct their immediate kind of coagulation abnormalities that they have in the first, you know, couple days of life, but then also gives them some extra vitamin K that their body can kind of use as needed as their kind of own gut flora ramps up and they kind of are taking in more vitamin K. And so I think having the higher dose allows you to have a little bit of backup vitamin K that your body can use over time and really avoid that kind of late onset vitamin K deficient bleeding that occurs in those weeks between like 2 and 12 weeks of life as babies are kind of growing. So it really just gives them what they need in the moment, but then also gives them a little extra to kind of get them through until they're kind of making more normal levels.
It's got to last for some months.
Right.
So, and I think we'd be remiss to point out that for our babies that we're talking about with vitamin K deficiency bleeding, typically those are going to be babies who are being fed with human milk. Formula does contain vitamin K. However, if you had a baby with liver dysfunction or a liver abnormality who was being formula fed, they could also have a risk for vitamin K deficiency bleeding. Is that correct?
Yes. So maternal milk does not contain very high amounts of vitamin K, regardless of kind of how much you eat or how much you supplement or those sorts of things. It's really not going to be able to be secreted in the same amount as you would find it in infant formula. And so that is certainly why we typically see more vitamin K deficient bleeding in our babies who are exclusively breastfed. We have patients who have presented who have abnormalities in how their vitamin K is absorbed. And so again, regardless of how much vitamin K they're getting in, if it's not able to get to their liver and kind of be used in that clotting factor manufacturing, it's not going to be effective at kind of preventing bleeding like you need it to be. So there certainly are situations where, regardless if you're supplementing in the best way possible, patients certainly can still have kind of medical complications that could lead to vitamin K deficiency.
So one of the other myths is that it's a moneymaker. And this one I do giggle about because I'm old enough to remember when some of the companies stopped making it because it actually wasn't a very lucrative product. I think the cost is somewhere around $20. And so, you know, is that something you've heard from patients or had concerns?
That's not one that I've heard specifically, but I could certainly see how people would think that. I think that in the terms of other things that are kind of going on in terms of a resuscitation for a baby and those sorts of things, I don't think that vitamin K injection is going to make or break their hospital stay in terms of investments or those sorts of things cost. But
definitely not.
But yeah.
Leukemia. So back in the 1990s, there was a database study done out of England that seemed to have some linkage point out between vitamin K and childhood leukemia. And that has been repeatedly debunked, but I still hear a bit circulating from time to time.
It's one of those things that I think once it's out there in the literature, it's always a little bit kind of hard for people to kind of overlook, especially people who maybe don't have as much practice kind of looking at different research articles and those sorts of things. This is where I think it's really helpful to talk to your pediatrician or to talk to another medical provider that you trust. That study was done and it was what we call a case control study, which is not the best kind of study to kind of look at these associations. And just because there's an association doesn't mean that one thing certainly caused the other. And so I think that it's out there, people are worried about it. We have certainly much better studies, kind of cohort studies where we're looking at a lot of patients over time that have really kind of refuted the claim that there's any sort of association between leukemia and the vitamin K injection. And when you look at it from kind of a scientific and evidence-backed standpoint, there's not an association that has been identified with multiple studies. But it's certainly something that I understand that people would be worried about. And so without having those conversations to explain why this paper might not be considered the best evidence and why some other studies might be a little bit better, it might be challenging for people to understand.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. Are there other ways for infants to receive vitamin K? Can mom take supplements or eat lots of leafy green vegetables? Can she increase the amount in her breast milk enough to prevent vitamin K deficiency bleeding?
So there have been trials that have looked at supplementing mom with vitamin K and then measuring the vitamin K in the breast milk. And the levels that mom has to take to get detectable levels in the breast milk are like not available like in any way in the store or anything like that. So it's really, really hard to boost your vitamin K levels enough in your breast milk to be able to kind of overcome some of the risks of bleeding and vitamin K deficient bleeding in an infant. When babies are given infant formula, it's supplemented in kind of a different way, and they're able to kind of use some different supplementation specifically into the formula that allows the babies to kind of have higher levels there as well. But in terms of supplementing via the mother, there's not anything that's been shown to be able to be effective.
Can we talk a little bit about oral vitamin K and sort of what's available in the U.S., what's not available? Just touch on that a little bit, if you would.
Sure. So we do not have a kind of approved version of oral vitamin K that's given in the United States. And so if you look at kind of different hospitals' policies on kind of what they're doing, how they're recommending oral vitamin K, it's really hard because we, even if we recommend oral vitamin K, we don't actually know how much vitamin K is in the formulation that the baby's getting. And so it's really hard as medical providers to say, take this medicine, but we don't actually know what's in it. I don't feel like most physicians are going to be really comfortable with that. And then there are also lots of different versions of oral regimens that have been tried. And lots of different countries in Europe use more oral formulations, but they all use a slightly different kind of schedule, which is really kind of confusing. And I think really hard to remember. So there's versions where you do three doses at different time points. There's versions where you do doses one a larger dose at the beginning and then give a dose every day through 12 weeks of life. And none of them have really shown to improve the late onset vitamin K deficient bleeding. So none of those have kind of eliminated that in the way that the injectable version of vitamin K kind of removes the risk of that. And so I think there's multiple reasons why it's generally not recommended here in the United States. Number one being we don't have an oral formulation. And then number two, there's not been studies that really show that one schedule of dosing is better than the other. And so there's not a good way to kind of recommend the oral version to families.
And in fact, in Denmark, they moved to oral and then went back to injectable because of the increased rates of vitamin K deficiency bleeding. So I do think that while the increase may be slight, it's not negligible. I mean, it is important to recognize that you do have an increased rate. So to kind of wrap this up, because I think we're getting close to time, what would you tell a parent who's concerned? How would you address their hesitancy and how would you encourage them to have that conversation really at a deeper level with their pediatrician?
Yeah, so I think it's important. Like I said, I'm a parent and I've had these, you know, thoughts when my daughter was born, and it's very hard to kind of recommend getting something that may or may not be an issue. But certainly when we look at kind of the scope of complications related to vitamin K deficient bleeding, I think it's a really important recommendation that we're making for all these families. So I typically would talk to a family and try and understand which one of the reasons that we talked about was really their kind of like main driver for kind of refusing it for their child, and then try and kind of just talk with them about the evidence that we have for how it works, the rationale behind why we give it the way that we do, maybe make some suggestions about ways if they're worried about the baby having a hard time with the shot, have the baby breastfeeding, or have other ways that we could try and make it more comfortable for them. And really just trying to kind of get to their main hesitation and then be able to kind of like talk to them about why we're making these recommendations and why we think that it's important for their baby to get the vitamin K injection.
That's super important. I think the biggest thing that I have is it can get a little bit exhausting to have these conversations over and over again, especially for me. I'm basically a newborn hospitalist. And so I have these conversations over and over again. It's the first time for that family, right? And so approaching that conversation with the same level of openness and time commitment that you would on your first time versus your 30th time, I think it's going to be really important that people carve out the time to have these conversations with their families so that families really feel like they're having the opportunity to ask questions and make a really informed choice. What other things did we need to hit on? Did we miss anything? Anything else that we need to chat about?
I don't think so. I think that those are most of the reasons that I have come across in terms of why families are kind of rejecting the injection. Like we talked about, I think it's hard when something's been recommended and in use since 1961 to really grasp on kind of a population level of like what happens if you don't do it, because most people haven't seen that and haven't run across that. But I think just being thoughtful and understanding and trying to take the time to understand why families are not interested in receiving it for their child and explaining the rare but very serious risks and patients that we see in the hospital who don't get it and try and kind of see if we can have some sort of way that we can make it better for them.
I agree. Thank you so much, Dr. Walker. We have truly appreciated you spending time with us today. We will put a link in the show notes to some additional information from the American Academy of Pediatrics. And thank you again.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, presented by TIPQC. TIPQC is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health. Do you have ideas for a future guest or topic, or even have a question you would like answered on upcoming episodes? Visit www.tipqc.org, that's TIPQC.org, and click on podcast to submit suggestions and questions to our podcast team. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast to be the first to know when new episodes are available and find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube to stay in the loop with our active projects and other relevant news relating to perinatal health in Tennessee.